The views, information, or opinions expressed in this broadcast are solely those of the individuals involved and do not represent those of any other persons or entities. Furthermore, some of the activities discussed might be dangerous or illegal. Attempt them at your own risk. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Peculiar World here on the Paranormal UK Radio Network. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. At present, 40 or so murders are committed each day in the United States. In the UK, the year 2014 had a statistical blip or upswing. There were 574 people killed that year, which is 1 to 2 people murdered each day. The number seems to be going up. I read one figure for 2017, which stated it had gone up to 2 to 3 people per day. How would you feel if you got into an elevator and learned that one of the people had just gotten out of prison for manslaughter? I would probably not follow through on it, but my first impulse would be to push the button and get out of the next floor. However, what would you feel and what would you do if you learned that one of the people on the elevator was a serial killer? While most of us would push the button and get out, I'm not so sure that everyone would, especially in America. I know a few people who would stay there and strike up a conversation with the serial killer. That's not all. Some people befriend serial killers, and more than one person is married to a serial killer who was in jail. What is our fascination with them? Why would someone befriend a serial killer, someone with no conscience, who may have murdered dozens of people? Western society has a fascination for serial killers, and I have a friend who is an expert on one of the most famous serial killers in history. Let me introduce my friend, Philip Hutchinson. Philip Hutchinson comes from Hampshire and has a lifelong interest in the macabre and the unpleasant, which began with a trip to Madame Tussaud's Chamber of Horrors when he was 6 years old. He began reading true crime books in his teens and followed this up by making day trips to London to visit the scenes of notorious homicides. He is a member of the Ghost Club, the oldest psychical organization in the world, and used to sit on that august body's council. He also started what he calls the Ghost Tour of Guildford, where he takes people through the town of Guildford and talks about his haunted history. However, before that, he had an even darker interest, if that's possible. His interest is Jack the Ripper. Philip has been a Ripper historian since 1990. But his deeper interest was kick-started when he worked as an actor at the London Dungeon in 1998. He has now been guiding Jack the Ripper tours as a freelance guide for well over a decade. He has lectured on the case in many places in the UK, often touring in a one-man lecture show titled Jack the Ripper: Facts, No Fiction. He is the author of the highly esteemed book, The London of Jack the Ripper, Then and Now, and The Jack the Ripper Location Photographs, Dutfield's Yard, and the Whitby Collection, as well as his book, Haunted Guildford. I just so happen to have copies of all three books. So, actor, author, lecturer, playwright, film critic, and aficionado of 78 albums, an all-around jolly fellow, especially after a vegan vanilla and vodka milkshake, welcome, Philip.
Well, thank you for having me, Jeff. It's not the day now. It's dark outside and raining and misty and late.
I keep on having to be reminded of this. This show, of course, airs off the Paranormal UK Radio Network, which is in the UK. And I am eight hours behind you. So for me, it's kind of the middle of the day. And you're staying up late, taking the time to talk to me. I appreciate that.
That's all right.
For those people who think that this interview is brand spanking new, this is our second attempt, and we've been having technical difficulties the entire time, but we will hopefully make it through with everybody's forbearance. It's so hard to remember where we kind of left off, but you are what some people call a ripperologist.
It's a somewhat derogatory term that was coined by Colin Wilson, the author on the Paranormal on the Ripper, many years ago. Some people like to call themselves that, but I prefer Ripper Historian now, being a bit of a snob.
Okay, I will do my best not to make that mistake again. I just want to...
Well, I won't get too upset about it, you know. There won't be bloodshed.
Well, it's a little hard for you to kill me right now, given the distance. But I will be in the UK in May, and I hope we do have a chance to get together.
I do hold grudges, but I think you're safe in this one.
Okay. It's not like I'm that guy on the train talking to his friends at 2 o'clock in the morning.
No, we didn't like that.
Now, as a Ripper historian, a little bit of background. In the introduction, I purposely did not spell out or give too much details. Jack the Ripper, if you could, maybe a little bit of background on him.
What about the murders themselves?
Yes.
Okay. Well, the Jack the Ripper murders are part of a larger scale of something that was known as the Whitechapel murders, which began with non-fatal attacks at the start of 1888 and finished in February 1891. This is a whole series of unsolved murders, particularly of prostitutes in the East End of London over that period, tended to be extremely violent, and the assailant was never caught, and there was never a motive found for any of these particular crimes. The Ripper murders themselves happened in just the autumn of 1888, from August until November that year. We don't know for sure how many victims were actually claimed by the Ripper because the man was never caught. And from then until now, researchers just tend to look at the various cases and decide for themselves which ones seem similar and therefore which ones they can attribute to the murderer. There's usually been five said, but some people think there's as few as three. Some people think it goes way up into double figures. A lot of us, including me, now think six rather than five.
Well, really, the five... were, and I'm going to, as an American, mispronounce this, canonical five. Go ahead.
Yeah, canonical, rather than canon, but be a but canonical, I suppose. they're also known as the McNaughton Five, because these five women were first named as being the probable victims of the one assailant by Sir Melvin McNaughton. Canonical is just a word that we tend to use now, because you say McNaughton Five and nobody knows who you're talking about.
And they were, if you can remember, in order?
I can remember. I hope so. It's the job. Right, not killing, by the way. That's not my job. I'll make this clear right now. The McNaughton Five, in order, are Mary Ann Nichols on the 31st of August, 1888. Annie Chapman on the 8th of September. Then two women in one night, Liz Stride and Catherine Eddowes, on the 30th of September. And then after 6 weeks of no murders, it's Mary Jane Kelly on the 9th of November, 1888.
Yeah, and it seems from looking at some of the literature that people are not quite agreeing how many victims, because the police didn't at first know that they had a serial killer. I think there was one woman... was killed. I cannot remember her name, but she was stabbed with like a pen knife.
That's Martha Tabram. That's the extra 6-1 at the start of August. And I firmly believe she was a Ripper victim, but she wasn't particularly attributed to him for many years. And nowadays people are starting to look at it afresh. The things counting in favor of her being one of the Ripper's victims are she died very close to the epicenter of where the murders happened. And it's a generalization, but very often serial killers tend to do the first murder quite close to where they live. Tabram's murder was two streets away from the epicenter. Also, she used to be discounted because her throat wasn't cut, unlike the other victims. Nowadays, we'd see this as being an escalation. People have disregarded it because you just had abdominal injuries. But I would look at it now as being each murder he does is the same as he did as the time before, with something extra, the exception being Liz Stride. The general belief is that she just had a throat cut because somebody came along and disturbed the murderer, who then went off and killed again 45 minutes later.
Okay, yeah, it makes sense. This is the nice thing about our interest in serial killers and the development of the science or the discipline of profilers. Some of the things that they used to think about serial killers, that they always acted alone and that they would never stop unless they were caught or somehow stopped by an outside force. We know that's not true. There are serial killer and killer pairs, And some serial killers have stopped on their own. But along with that, there is, as you said, escalation the first time might be tentative. We've kind of gone forward a little bit. At the time, things not well on the East End of London, setting the socioeconomic stage for a serial killer. What was happening around that time in that East End?
Well, this was 1888, was the year after the centenary, sorry, the year before, rather, the centenary of the French Revolution. And there had already been protests in Trafalgar Square, and the poor had been beaten down by the police. There was a general prevalence of a feeling in the West End of London. People who lived in the East were there through moral degeneracy, through laziness, through carelessness, and that women who sold themselves for sex were doing it because they had no morals. They couldn't comprehend in the West End that people could be living who were just like them, who had no money, and they lived hand-to-mouth existences through no fault of their own, because they were sitting there almost literally in their ivory castles. They had no idea, and they couldn't comprehend that people could have be living in astute poverty, just through the economics of the time and their own background, and the fact that they didn't have anything to be able to aspire to, because the East End was overcrowded, and per square foot accommodation there in some places was more expensive than living in the West End. But accommodation there was so limited and so tiny, that you would obviously be paying less overall, because the space you'd have would be much less.
Part of the overcrowding, of course, was coming from every couple of years there seemed to be an influx of, God forbid, foreigners.
There have been that part of the East End where the murders occurred had always been a largely immigrant area around Whitechapel and Spitalfields and around Aldgate and the docks. This had been simply because it wasn't too far from where the docks were, and obviously where boats would come in. There had been initially the Huguenots escaping persecution in Catholic France, and the Irish were there escaping the potato famine, and previous to that digging the canals and the railways. Then we had the Jewish influx that was coming in, escaping pogroms in Eastern Europe just before the Ripper murders, and indeed during that time. And then it became not largely, but featuring in quite a high degree a Muslim area in the 70s, which a lot of it still is now. The next influx we're getting these days is the rich from the city, who are now moving out and doing up these ancient listed buildings, which have a lot of space, and turn them into very desirable and very expensive properties. Obviously, at the time, these places were some distance from the centre of London, but as the years go by, London expands so much that somewhere that was the East End is now almost central London, and people are finding it desirable to live there because it's quite close to work.
Yeah, and this reminds me, even in those days, in that Whitechapel area, the poverty map actually showed well-to-do housing, like on the street fronts, and these vicious semi-criminals in back?
That's right. That's Charles Muth's descriptive map of London poverty. It was undertaken the year after the Ripper murders. It was never finished because the project itself was far too ambitious. Muth's plan was to take street maps of London and visit every area. And initially, it was meant to be like a census return, visiting house to house and finding out the rough income of each household. And he would colour each building on the map depending on the income of the people living there. A lot of the Whitechapel area was painted black and blue, which were the lowest classes, being a very lower working class or what was called at the time a vicious stroke semi-criminal. The project was far too ambitious. And consequently, as time went on, Booth just went and painted whole streets depending on the income of one or two houses. So it didn't become as precise as it had been. But these things are still used today for people studying history and sociology and economics.
I have been quite privileged. You have taken me on kind of behind the scenes on your own Jack the Ripper walk.
It's not that bad around there. There's quite a strong sense of community. It used to be very transient because people had no money at all. They'd do a moonlight flip. It was like just a whole series of what consequently we would call being run-down flop houses. And so people would stay a couple of nights for as much as they could afford, then move on or stay as long as they could until they got chucked out for not paying. Nowadays, with the community there, most of these places are all right. But there's one or two streets I'm not so keen on, but it's not really dodgy. You just don't make eye contact with certain people who look like they're taking nefarious substances.
Yes, you and I went up to this one parking garage, I remember.
Yeah. Oh, yes, well, we went up Weiss Row Car Park. That used to be a haven for prostitution and drug deals. Yeah, if we went on top of that, I mean, obviously it's no longer there now. It was demolished some years ago. But it did have a very bad reputation. I never encountered anything bad there, but you would usually see someone curled up in the corner who'd been taking something they shouldn't, yeah.
I will also say here in the United States, it's not like England is the only country on earth that has a drug problem. So we see that here too, not too far away from where I'm sitting right now, actually. Back to your walks. I remember we were in between walks and you were taking me, we were going to get a curry. And we walked that one street and every place there was what in America I call a keyholer, somebody trying to bring you, a maitre d' trying to bring you into the restaurant.
Yeah, they're not actually allowed to do that. The police cracked down on it, but after about 2 weeks of it happening, they're still doing it now. It's not aggressive. They don't make physical contact with you. They just stand on the street and actually just like gesture you to come in. And they wouldn't rip you off. You know, they're just after stuff your business.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yes, I agree. It was kind of interesting. It was very entrepreneurial of them to do that.
Yeah, and it still happens most nights now. I tend to not get it myself because they see me about every other night, so they know that I won't be coming in there for a meal because I'm leaving at all.
Yeah, but I bet you if you were walking with company, if you and I were walking there again, they'd try and pull me in.
Yeah, quite possibly.
And I guess for some people would go on your walk, and yours is the best. I've been on four separate walks, billed as Jack the Ripper walks, and yours is the best. That
maybe of those four, I don't know if I go on the best by any means. I certainly appeal to a certain demographic. There's some people probably wouldn't like what I do so much. I come out with a lot of facts, but it's done quite lightheartedly.
Have to break the stress with a little bit of jocularity, otherwise it'd break your heart.
Yeah, it's very much gallows humor. It's all done deliberately because the subject matter itself is so dark and unsettling. I find if you did it with the gravitas it deserves, people would be leaving the tour feeling very miserable.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, the reason I was in London that time was I used to, and I still do, visit community groups, colleges and things, and I ended up, of course, adding a Jack the Ripper talk to my repertoire, and you were most helpful. I remember giving one of my talks and having some of these crime scene photos, and somebody asked me a question. And so I started answering the question. I didn't remember that the photograph on the screen was an autopsy photo, and I was talking for like 3 or 4 minutes and people got up out of their chairs and they left because, and I asked them what's wrong. And they said, that picture is just so disturbing.
Wow. That's understandable. People ask me now sometimes, especially the school tours, and we do a lot of tours for schools, and they say, you know, don't you find the pictures disturbing? I'm detached from them now because I've seen them so often. I'm anesthetized to them. Seeing a crime photographs obviously can bother me, especially if I haven't seen them before. There's certain images that always unsettle me. If I have to do with this, it's not something I really talk about, but the image of Ruth Snyder being electrocuted, that picture terrifies me. I can't look at it. You know, so there are some things that freak me out, but those particular images, the mortuary images and the seeing a crime photograph of Mary Kelly, I see them so often now I'm detached and I can just look at them clinically.
One of my friends is a professional artist, and I asked him, and he did. He ended up colorizing those crime photos for me because to some people, if it's in black and white, it's not real. And you know what? The first time I saw this, he did them as a GIF so that you're looking at the black and white photograph, and in a period of about 5 seconds, it turns color. Yeah, the first couple times, it was unsettling to me too.
Yeah, because it brings it into focus. It removes it from its historical context. It's rather like that Peter Jackson film, They Shall Not Grow Old, you know, the one with all the World War One footage that's been an international success, where he's treated everything, cleaned it up, he's corrected the speed, he's put color in, he's removed all the detritus from various frames, and this footage of the First World War now looks like modern film, and it's far more disturbing because it puts you there rather than having that detachment through being on the other side of an image.
Yes, and he added as voiceover interviews done with World War I veterans, I'm presuming the 1950s through the 70s, and he was very careful to pick, dare I say this, good audio.
Yes.
And other things that ended up happening that we would just kind of look at and say, yeah, you know, why don't you guys just do this? Genetic testing and things. They didn't have that then.
Oh, no. Well, the whole thing about DNA is that the science wasn't on this side. It wasn't the fact that, they had no idea it existed per se. It was simply that we didn't have the scientific methods to extract DNA in those days. And indeed, the first DNA case of solving a murder was here in the UK in 1986, so it's a century later.
You guys are such...
At the time, we couldn't even tell if blood came from anything other than a mammal. We didn't have anything like blood grouping, no way to identify that.
I've purposely led our conversation a little bit into modernism in that every year there seems to be five or six new-to-press Jack the Ripper books, and every couple years something that is billed as the I Have Solved the Crime books.
Yeah.
You want
my opinion on that?
I'm not going to be sued, so sure.
These big names always come up when someone has a big publisher behind them. It never tends to be someone who's an enthusiast and a historian who knows what they're talking about, who's self-published. You never find the stuff in the papers. It's people who've got a huge publicity machine behind them. Very often people already have a lot of money themselves or already quite famous. And people just tend to use whatever witness statements suit their own suspect, and they mold the book around using the evidence that suits their suspect, or disregarded the mountain of evidence that counts against their potential solving of the case. Most people who are really interested in the Ripper now, we try and almost entirely step away from suspectology because we think it's a futile parlor game, really.
Yeah, how many people, we've got the canonical five as far as the murder victims, but I have not even done a count, but over the years, 20, 30, 40 possible suspects?
More than that. There's been books brought out by various authors over the last decade or so that go up to well over 100 different suspects.
Yeah, including one or two women.
Yes, but again, that would be fairly easy to disregard. These women were almost always seen with men shortly before they died, and they were killed with a great deal of physical brute force. So if it's a woman doing it, then she's got muscles the size of battleships.
And she was.
Sounds terribly sexist, which I apologize.
It's okay, and most of them did not have a foreign appearance, which seemed to have been part of the description of some of the men.
That's true, but again, we can't be totally sure if people really did see a man who looked foreign appearance. And by foreign at that time, they generally meant Polish Jewish, because there wasn't a great deal of light to see them by during the night time, and a lot of it may have been fueled by simple anti-Semitism.
Mm-hmm. Find a straw man to put whatever transference of all your anxiety on.
Yeah, rather like the media do now. You know, it's just people doing it individually, just getting their own prejudices out by picking on someone innocent.
Yeah, well, and in the case of some of these more modern authors, by proxy, 100 and some years later, kind of picking on somebody, the one that sticks out to me, most recent book, was a genetic testing, wasn't it?
Oh, is this the one where they thought it solved it because they had had a piece of one of the aprons tested for DNA?
Well, that one, the shawl, but also the stamps on the envelope?
Well, the stamps on the envelope, that was all to do with Patricia Cornwell, wasn't it? And Portrait of a Killer book from 2002, Walter Sickert, the artist.
My wife, she bought a copy of the book, said, Jeff, you've got to read this. She was also a fan of Patricia Cornwell's other work.
I've met quite a few people over the years who are fans of Cornwell's Scott Petter novels, and they like them, but I've met very few people who managed to get to the end of Portrait of a Killer.
Except you, I'm sure.
No, I've never read it.
Oh, okay.
I know a fair deal about the contents, but I've not read it. I'm a terrible philistine. I've got shelves full of Ripper books. Most of them have never been read, because they tend to say exactly the same thing, and when they do say something different, it's something that they're supposing rather than something they know.
You're kind of jaded.
Oh, yeah. A terrible cynic.
But But if you could, from what you know, maybe summarize a little bit about Patricia Cornwall's findings.
Well, Cornwall believed that the artist Walter Sickert, who has the same birthday as me, so it can't be all bad, was Jack the Ripper, and she claimed that it was evident in his paintings, and she tried to construct a case saying that because he lived in Camden in London, that he was responsible for the Ripper murders, because he used to enjoy painting prostitutes and the poor of London and scenes around the music halls and poverty, rather than what a lot of other people were doing at the time, was painting things artistically that were more salubrious. And she claimed that he did these murders, and then although he was staying in France when some of them happened, that he took a boat back to France, he copied to under a different name after each murder to go back on holiday, which is just ridiculous. But the DNA thing, the thing that really linked Sickert to it, which is interesting, but it by no means proves that he was a Ripper, is that she found one of the hoax letters, of which there was about 700 of them, and she started comparing hoax letters to Sickert's own handwriting. Now, even if these things did match up, there's nothing to say that he's the killer, because there's a hoax letter that matches his handwriting. It just means he would have written a hoax letter. But she found the handwriting extremely similar on two of these letters. Now, that in itself is not that amazing, because people with an education were taught to write with exactly the same style of handwriting. That there wasn't a sense of individuality in the style of writing then. You know, you're taught about to do this copperplate writing, so you can't put a great deal on graphology at the time. But what she did find that was more interesting is that one of the hoax letters and one of Sickert's letters that she managed to get on loan shared the same rare watermark, and there was a guillotine error on the bottom of the sheet, and there's only been, I believe, 24 sheets found with the same rare watermark and the same guillotining error, and they're all a part of the effects of Walter Sickert. The DNA she found on it is less exciting, because both these items, the hoax letter and the Sickert letter, have been handled by a lot of people over the years, and it's unlikely DNA would have been found matching Sickert, that far more likely than someone else who's handled them recently. But it does almost certainly prove, by the fact that the paper that it was written on was so rare, that Sickert probably wrote a hoax letter. And it's not surprising, he was an eccentric character. So he wasn't Jack the Ripper.
He was just part of the crowd.
Yeah, nowadays we'd find it absolutely abhorrent that you would actually try and sully a police investigation by muddying the waters and writing hoax letters. I mean, a man called John Mumble here in the UK, who was very famous for sending a tape cassette to the Yorkshire police at the time, saying that he was Peter Sutcliffe, the Yorkshire Ripper, just saying that he... And in fact, he actually used one of the hoax Ripper letters as a reference point in it. He was convicted for something. He spent years in prison because for making a fake claim that he was a Ripper, because he started looking for a man with his northeastern accent rather than Sutcliffe's West Yorkshire accent. And indeed, it made the case more difficult. More women died as a result of it. So nowadays, if somebody did that kind of thing, they're quite rightly be prosecuted for it. But in those days, it was thought to be a bit of fun and games.
Of all of these letters, how many of them, if any, do you think actually came from Jack the Ripper?
Personally, I don't think any of them came from the Ripper, but it's a matter of personal choice. If any of them are likely to be genuine, it would be the one that was written to George Lusk, the chairman of the Whitechapel Vigilance Committee, that he received on the 16th of October, 1888, simply because the handwriting wasn't done in an educated style. It was very angular, quite roughly done, and because the letter also was accompanied by half a human kidney in a box. Many people have claimed over the years that's half the kidney of the Ripper victim, Catherine Eddowes. Nowadays, there's a bit more of a question mark over it. There's things been linked to it being genuine that actually aren't true. Things like renal artery still being attached to the kidney that George Lusk received, when in fact the kidney he did receive had the renal artery cut away. It's all to do with the length of the renal artery, how much was left inside Catherine Eddowes' body, and apparently how much was attached to the kidney that George Lusk got. The thing that makes it stand out as being more interesting is the fact it was preserved in spirits of wine rather than formalin, which you would have expected a medical specimen to have preserved it. There's a question mark over that, but I'm still fairly sure it's fake. So I don't think any of them are real. It's not that often that serial killers do communicate with the authorities by letters. There have been cases, famous ones, but of course they tend to be famous because of that. That they gain more interest in, you know, things like Berkowitz and obviously Zodiac and Dennis Rader. These people did write taunting letters to the police, but the reason they're so famous is not just because of the body count, but because of the method of communication. It's quite rare for serial killers to communicate with the police.
That reminds me, I have some tie-ins to this too. In the 1980s, I was stationed at Fort Lewis, Washington, not too far from the Green River, and the post was open at the time. I remember going over to the offices of one of the other sergeants who was in charge of apportioning ammunition. We were getting ready to range qualification, and he didn't show up. And finally he did. He had been held by the military police because he went out to one of the ranges and he found one of the bodies. And oftentimes the person who finds the body, quote, finds the body, is actually the killer. So they held him and cross-examined him. My ex-wife, Janine, also, before she and I met in the 80s when Ridgeway was active, she was driving down Interstate 5, the major highway, and this van followed her for some time. She noticed him, and then he pulled alongside of her and paralleled her and honked his horn and was pointing at the back of her car as if something's wrong. And she kept on going and said, "I'll stop at the next gas station." And after a minute or two, the guy took off. Now, she ended up pulling into the gas station. He wasn't there, and there was nothing wrong with her car. And she still wonders whether or not that was not Gary Ridgeway.
Wow. That's something to carry with you, isn't it? It's not very pleasant.
Yeah, the whole thing of it could be me there, but for the grace of God and things like that. Now both of us are pausing. Which is why I get curious about people loving serial killers.
You say loving serial killers?
Metaphorically and physically, several American serial killers have been married whilst in prison.
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, I think the cases with Danny Rolling and Bundy and Ramirez and things like that. Yeah, it's and Manson, of course, and it pretty much happened, didn't it, before he died. I'm not a psychologist, you know. I'm just an armchair detective, really. I can understand why people can be fascinated by it, but my fascination comes through fear and revulsion, that little thing we've all got inside us that gets enjoyment out of being scared. That's where my interest in this thing comes from. When you match it with being an interest in history as well, that's really where my interest in it all comes from. People who are communicating with a convicted murderer, I could see why that could be something viable in the short term, not as a friendship, but getting a greater understanding in some way. But it's not something I wouldn't want to meet one. I wouldn't want to be friends with one. And people wanting to marry them, it's an odd thing. The people wanting to belong. Very often, these people do dismiss the idea of celebrity and fame with notoriety.
Yes, and as I myself continue researching, because I'm a curious guy as well, I don't understand either, but there are people who write love letters to serial killers who almost volunteer to be their proxies and copycat killers too.
Oh, sure. Did that with the Hillside Stranglers, that one of them actually got a girlfriend to try and kill other people on his behalf. It's a crazy world.
Absolutely. And that's kind of the reason I started with the intro I did, just pointing all of this out, that maybe that's the marker of the reason you and I are not serial killers, is because while we have a curiosity about it, we're not so into it that we carry duct tape in our glove compartments.
Yeah, I've been worried many times about why do I have this interest, and I've done all these psychological tests, just the ones online, but they can be quite detailed, and every time I come back as virtually 0% psychopathy. I'm a classic empath, I'm a real busybody and I feel everybody's pain, I want to solve everybody's problems. I kind of have a detachment from another human being.
Oh, me, I come back as just strange, but not dangerously strange, though.
Well, there's nothing. I do love entertaining people. I like to make people fascinated. I want to talk to people, but I only want to do it if they want me to talk. I don't want to force myself on anyone. So when you know about stuff that's interesting, that fascinates people, and they want you to speak to them, that's great. And that's kind of what the tour guiding is. You know, the murder does fascinate people, and I enjoy talking about it because people are interested.
Right, right. And you do a great job of it. As modest as you have been, as I've been praising you for your tour, for its accuracy and entertainment value, let's face it, that's what people want too. They want to be entertained and educated at the same time. You would know better than me. It's been a while since I've been in the UK, but there are maybe a half dozen different companies that are running their own Jack the Ripper walks.
There's more than half a dozen. That was about as many as there was when I started doing it 16 years ago. There's about 20 of them now.
Right, and these are organized tours with guides and like a website and ticketing system. I'm also also the entrepreneurs that are waiting outside the tube stop with a cardboard sign that's all beat up, but it says Jack the Ripper walk here.
Yeah. So what do you want my views on that, man?
I was getting ready to allude to some of the logistical difficulties that I noticed as a tourist going on some of these tours, just so many of you.
Oh, yeah. It's terrible for the locals because I'm part of this circus that's there every night. And as the years have gone by, it's got worse and worse. A couple of times a night, it's not so bad. But you get some of the guys standing there with headsets and speakers, other people shouting their heads off. It's not pleasant for the people that live there, logistically for us as guides, because there's so many other tours now. At one point, you could pretty much guarantee every spot you wanted to get to, just week two group would be available. And nowadays, every night, there'd be a couple of places where there's someone already standing where you usually stand. So you have to improvise and go and stand somewhere else. Some guides would move somewhere else and say, this is the spot, right? I couldn't do that. I'd have to say, down there. But then, and then make a joke about burning the other group.
Right. As a matter of fact, the last time I was with you on your tour or close to it, I remember the last murder being Mary Kelly, and the murder site is now under a couple feet of concrete.
Yeah.
In that grocery warehouse. And
well, it's only the facade of the fruit and wood exchange that stands there now. It's only one face of it on Brusfield Street. The entire block has been rebuilt where Dorset Street used to be, and the passageways leading off it to where Mary Kelly died. They've been totally built over by this brand new office block.
Oh, but what I remember too was how exacting you were using GPS and photos and many other different ways of determining where the entrance to the cottage where she was murdered was located, and it was inside the warehouse and not too far from a roll-up door. And in this instance, you were standing there with your tour, and we were all there alone at first, and this is where 18-wheeler trucks will back themselves up to offload on a raised concrete platform about 3 feet high.
That's all gone now. All those buildings are gone. The multi-story car park we referred to earlier, those warehouses, that road, that entire block is now under a big office.
Well, so ends that part of the tour. The thing that was most amusing to me was you kind of turn to face the group, and all of us are trying to be polite. So your tour group, me included, we all positioned ourselves within the yellow lines that the trucker would back into to stay in place. And you proclaimed, and I'll do my really bad English imitation, "Behind me is the place where the poor lady Mary Kelly was killed." And as you were talking, I think three other tours arrived, and the guides offset themselves. So we were within one of these set of white lines, and then there was an empty space, and then another tour. And then as they arrived, all of the guides turned and faced their tour groups and said virtually the same thing. directly behind me is the site of the house where Mary Kelly was killed. And
yeah, and I've seen that happen a lot. And of course, you've only got my word for it that I'm telling the truth. I am, but I can't prove it to you unless you're going to come in with a match yourselves and check it out. If I can't get you to the spot, I'll tell you exactly where it was.
Right, and I appreciate that. There have been a lot of other changes in development. One of the other sites that was almost intact was a place called Mitre Square.
Yeah, and that's changed a lot over the last 2 years. It's quite anodyne now. It's bigger than it was. It's got trees to an extent, shrubs around it, two big raised grass areas in it. It's quite nice. There's a massive office block in one corner, which looks very dystopian, but I actually quite like it. But there's no sense of the old Mitre Square left at all anymore. It's about 50% bigger. It's changed shape as well. The inside of the square is now completely paved with flagstones. There's no roadway into it. There's still the two passages leading out. They're still there. But the whole thing is much wider and far more open, so there's no sense of the Victorian anymore there.
Oh, that's too bad. But I'm sure... when you take your tours through, you can set the stage and people will internalize and kind of figure things out.
Oh, yeah, well, again, it's part of my job. You know, they can't see these things anymore, so I say exactly where everything was. And then I pass around photos showing the square as it was at the time.
Right. And if people have a little bit more ambition, you actually have a book that will help them, I think.
Oh, I've done two books. The one... I've done several books, but on the Ripper I've done two. The one that shows all the areas then and now is called The Londoner Jack Ripper Then and Now, which came out 12 years ago. It's still in print though.
Yeah, I have a copy of that, and it is amazingly helpful. You get to see what the places look like. I think a couple of them are in the day, but some of them a couple of years later, but it's before renovation destroyed it.
Yeah, and the sad thing is that the comparative shots for now, a lot of those ones are now historical pieces in themselves because they've been redeveloped again over the last few years. The regeneration of the area is so rapid, there's something I like pointing out to people on the tour. I've got a photograph here at home that was taken of Aldgate High Street, Whitechapel High Street rather, which is where we start the tours in 1985. And the view is mostly filled with high-rise buildings. All those high-rise buildings have gone and been replaced with new high-rise buildings. So it's not just the old buildings that have gone, but ones that replace them are already themselves nearing the end of their lives and being replaced by new structures, which I have to say, for the most part, are better than the builds from the 60s and 70s and the 80s. Yeah, there's less concrete now. Some of the buildings are very bland and uninspired, but there are some success stories. There's a bit more colour.
That pesky fire in the 1600s and the renovation after that needed a lot of work.
Well, it's not looking so Tudor anymore. You went to go to York or Chester for something like that, I think.
I always encourage people who listen to my podcast, here's an opportunity for you, go see it yourself. And so I don't want Americans who've never been to the UK to get the idea that it is going to look like something out of a reenactment. London is a modern city. It does things, not just... doesn't exist as a tourist trap.
Yeah, that's right. The East End's a living area. I mean, these things were never designed. The Ripper wasn't thinking in 1880, I'm going to murder this woman here because it's not going to change over the next century. You know, everything looks different now. You can still get to all the places. We still know exactly where everything is, but none of them look the same anymore.
And I'm trying to remember the Seven Bells? Ten Bells.
Yeah, well, that was there at the time, but I think more import is attributed to it than it really deserves. Some of the victims were known to have drunk there, and two of them were drinking there the night they died, so that's really why it remains so famous. But there's other pubs in the area that the victims used as well, and people don't talk about them.
Yes, one of them had billed themselves as the Jack the Ripper pub. Was that the Ten Bells?
It was, yeah. Between 1975 and 1988, they called themselves the Jabba Ripper. And obviously, there was pressure from various groups because it's not really a great idea to celebrate the serial killer in that way. So the name was changed back to the Ten Bells in 1988.
You know, I am so glad, Philip, that you are an encyclopedia of Jack the Ripper and his times, that you can answer these questions. Which is
just ask me the right ones. Ask me something in that police investigation. I'll be no good with that.
Okay. Was Jack left or right-handed?
I think I can answer that as well. Some people have claimed left-handed, but I'm fairly positive he was right-handed. The incisions to the victim's necks were fairly uniform. They were very deep. And they tended to go from the left to the right. Generally these days, what that denotes is that he would have murdered them from behind by holding their heads back and then cutting their throat with them. I'm doing this, you can imagine I'm doing this with my hand as I say it. They're cutting their throats from the left to the right with his right hand. If he was cutting them from the front, which would have denoted him being left-handed, then the wounds to the neck would have been concave because of the arc that you make against the arc of a neck. Would have been in conflict. So when you get down to the spine, you know, you'd be making the same arc as the back of the neck rather than the front of it. So it generally denotes that he killed him with his right hand from behind rather than with the left hand from the front.
Okay, Mr. Smarty Pants. What was his hair color?
Sandy, apparently. The most common witness statement that was repeated was saying they had a small sandy-coloured moustache. So he might have been a redhead. I don't think that's very likely, but it's a possibility.
You do have an answer for almost every question.
No, I'm just bluffing. No, this is, I was being serious. That was the answer that they said he had a moustache. It tended to be Sandy was the name that was given.
I'm going to point out some preconceives that Hollywood has given us that's not true, that it was always foggy every single time that he struck. That's not true either.
No, not true at all. The pea super fogs we had that went on well until the 1950s was caused by the smog, the pollution from the factories and everything. You just don't get fog in London much anymore. I can count on one hand in 16 years the amount of times I've done the tour in fog. It's quite rare. But there was no fog on the night of any Ripper murder. It was raining most of the nights it happened, but you can ignore the fog. That's just there for show.
We've been talking, believe it or not, almost a full hour now, and to have not scratched the surface nor removed the skin on Jack the Ripper and his victims.
Dietrich had a technical breakdown, which has been quite amazing.
You're quite right there. This is, again, our second attempt, and it took us almost 40 minutes to just get the sound system up and running. We had it running perfect, and then somebody, not me, had to go ahead and change his microphone around, and then bad things happened.
Right. You now changed the story to saying everything when we were trying to set up was at your end and not mine. Just for the sake of your listeners. And I just outed you for the moment.
I have been outed for different things, so that's okay. And I am not going to ask you if you even have an idea who Jack the Ripper was, because I want people to take your tour.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, and so as we're winding down a little bit, if you could share how people can find you, because you also do Ghost Walks of Guildford, your hometown, and you do some other amazing things. So how would people find you?
Well, I'm a freelance guide as a Jack the Ripper guide. It's the only thing I do in London for a company called Discovery Tours. You might also see them down as London Walks, but if you see Discovery Tours, Jack the Ripper Tour, and there's loads of companies out there, so make sure you don't get the wrong one. If you type in my name, Philip Hutchinson, and that's with one L because that's how you spell it in the UK, and then put Jack the Ripper Tour, you'd probably come up at some point with Discovery Tours. If you see the name Richard Jones anywhere, he's my employer, and that's the company I work for. They've got a load of different websites, which is why I'm not going to give a web address, because they've got various ones for various aspects of what they do. The ghost tours are in Guildford. That's just something I do myself, and that's just through the summer months each year, just running on Friday nights. You can find that at Ghost Tour of Guildford, and that's Guildford with a D.co.uk. And, of course, my main thing in life is that I am an actor, which you may have guessed from my delivery. But I think you knew that anyway. So I run a theatre company called Lucky Dog Theatre Productions, and we do loads of plays about real-life events concerning the East End. I wrote an accurate play about Joseph Merrick, the Elephant Man, as opposed to the film and the Broadway show, which are fictions. And also one about the Bethnal Green Shoe disaster in 1943, which was the biggest civilian disaster in the UK of World War II. 173 people were killed on a staircase by being crushed during an air raid. No bombing involved in it. And mostly our stuff revolves around doing pieces concerning Laurel and Hardy. Both of us are huge Laurel and Hardy fans, so we've got three different shows about them. One is their radio scripts, one is a lot of sketches they did at the music hall, and one which we have actually played in California is a biopic called Hats Off to Laurel and Hardy, which is an accurate biopic rather than the film that's out at the moment, which is not accurate.
You know, Hollywood, they've got a... Real life is never dramatic enough.
Yeah, listen, but it's something I'm passionate about. I can watch any film that I know is telling lies about people. Like Bohemian Rhapsody, the film about the rock group Queen. There's loads of fiction in that, but I was fine with it because I knew it wasn't true. What annoys me about the errors made with the Laurel and Hardy film is that I know what the true story is, and there'll be a lot of people watching it. Most people, in fact, watching it will have no idea that these big fights they're supposed to have had never happened. They'd been made up for the film. Unfortunately, the truth wouldn't be believable. In fact, these two men loved each other and never argued. That wouldn't look good on the screen.
Yes, I was part of some of the online discussion about this. I was just, it is an American expression, slightly yanking your chain a little bit. I hope you don't mind.
No, not at all.
Now, you're such a skinny guy, Philip. So how is it playing? How is it playing Stan Laurel?
Shut your face. Well, I had to eat Stan Laurel to get to this size. I do that a lot when people find out that I'm part of a Laurel and Hardy double act. They say, and as I say to them, so if you guess too quickly which one I play, I'll hit you.
I've got to ask this, and this is my ignorance, but I'll ask this as a serious question. He is Oliver Hardy's nickname was Babe.
Yes.
And when you portray him, did he in real life do that whole tie flip thing with his fingers?
Oh yeah, he did it in one of the boy's early films in 1928. Oh, it's something to do with sailors. Should Sailors Marry, I think. I can't remember the title of it offhand, which is terrible because I should be able to rule off these 107 films off the top of my head. But he got a bucket of water thrown over him, and the camera stayed on him, and he didn't know what to do, so he just twiddled his tie, and he got such a big laugh, he kept it in. It's meant to be just a show of awkwardness and not knowing what to say or do and feeling embarrassed. So yeah, he did keep that in, he did do that. Not himself in real life, just as his character.
Oh, okay. Thanks for clarifying that. This is the nice thing about being the producer of my own podcast is we can take this conversation from Jack the Ripper to arguably the two funniest men in the world, Laurel and Hardy.
Don't blame us too.
Well, you know, my ex-wife didn't think I was funny. Okay, Janine, if you listen to this, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding.
But not very well.
Yeah, you're right there, too. Is there anything we haven't talked about that you still want to talk about that we've missed?
No, I don't think so. No, we haven't really spoken about ghosts, but ghosts as a major interest in me is ironically faded away into the distance a lot over the last few years. You and I met, of course, because through research into the paranormal. But I was a council member of the Ghost Club's oldest paranormal organisation for 13 years. My interest has waned a bit because the more I've seen as the years go by, the less I believe. I don't think it's all fake, but when you're not believing most of it and just have an interest in the stories behind them, it's not as involving as it once was, so you take a bit of a backseat.
We will definitely have come back for another hour-long chat and definitely talk about that. And as a teaser to anybody listening, I remember you said one of the most interesting things to me. At a certain point, you said something like, and I paraphrase, because you'll correct me otherwise.
Why don't you get out of this country as quickly as possible? You're scaring me. Was that it?
You also somewhere added bloody yank in that, too. No, it was more along the lines of you said that you weren't even sure separating out what some people might consider a ghost, that you kind of had atheistic leanings, but you believed in psychic ability too.
I don't really believe in psychics. I believe And so mediums and things like that, I don't believe in them. I do believe in the possibility of ESP, simply because it's known to exist in the animal kingdom. So it is a thing, it does exist. So I think very often when mediums say that they've been in contact with spirits, sometimes there could be things, maybe extremely minor, but they may be able to read something inside your mind. And it could just be through things like body language and your responses, which a lot of people are very trained in.
Right, and not even trained as in trying to put one over on somebody, but they're just really good at reading people.
Yeah, a lot of people are trying to con people, but I think there are people out there who really believe they've got some psychic ability to see into the beyond. They are seeing these things, but they're seeing something from someone's current mind rather than something that's stuck in the past somewhere. I think a lot of ghost sightings are to do with that as well. It's something Arthur C. Clarke said, that he thinks sometimes the eyes act as a projector rather than the camera. And you see things that aren't there. So you are seeing a ghost, but it's not something that's sentient. It's not something from another time. It's something that is there, but you've created, and maybe only you can see.
I think I've said this on another podcast. I probably have said it three or four times. I have a friend who I believe is a clairvoyant. She's better than the law of averages, as if she were, quote, guessing. And we were at a cemetery, she said, and I asked her, so, yeah, spirits of the dead? And she said, nope, there aren't any dead people here. All of the psychic energy in this place is really coming from and has been put down by everybody who attended the funerals. It's that sense of mourning and loss and that electromagnetic energy that other people are picking up on.
That's a very interesting viewpoint. I could get on board with that.
Yeah, me too.
I don't believe it, but I wouldn't question it too far. I think it's quite a sensible idea.
Yeah, I think so too. Oh gosh, I am probably going to end up having to cut some of this, so we'll talk.
Just cut the bits with me, and it'll be more interesting that way.
No. I'm going to do the opposite. People don't want to hear me; they want to hear you.
So you say.
Hey, I know my audience. For some reason, they tune in.
My audience hate me; they don't listen to me.
Well, sorry about that, audience. Anyway, let's you and I sign off, Philip, and we can continue the interesting conversation, a more rude form. How's that?
Yeah, fine.
Okay, if there's nothing else to add, I want to thank everybody for tuning in. I hope you found this interesting, because this is not just your average Jack the Ripper talk, I hope. And please stay tuned and visit Philip, buy his books, and see his many Laurel and Hardy and other play works. You can say bye to Philip.
I don't want to. I don't want him to leave. I want him to stay here with me.
You know what? The average serial killer who collects a trophy says the same thing.
Damn.
All right. We're going to sign off for now. All right? Bye. And we're off. Before you all go, I just want to let you all know that I will have on my website some links and a bit of a biography on Philip for you to visit. So if you go to my website, www.ghostsandcritters.com, it's all one word, you can find some links to Philip and my other podcast in the What's New section. So please tune in. And with that final note, Philip is already gone. I wish you a good night. Our theme music has been Danse Macabre by Camille Saint-Saëns, performed by Kevin MacLeod. www.incompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0. Thank you for listening to The Peculiar World here on the Paranormal UK Radio Network.